We're now moving into the third session, the panel, Critical Writing in Australia. And I'd like to invite Fulvia Mantelli to the microphone.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to be here for like 30 seconds and then we're all going to sit down. I'd want to start with acknowledging that we are meeting on Kaurna land today, and I'd like to pay my respects to the Kaurna people, whose spiritual and cultural connections, of course, are very strong and ongoing to the country of the Adelaide Plains. Let's sit down and have a yarn. So I've taken that my role is really to prod these guys and ask questions. I'm generally quite good at that, as opposed to answering them. I'm going to start with introducing Eve Sullivan. Yes. Eve Sullivan right here is the executive editor of Artlink magazine since July 2014. She's previously worked as an editor at Macmillan Education Australia, Oxford University Press in the UK, and as in-house editor at the National Gallery of Australia. Eve has contributed articles, interviews and reviews to Artlink, Art Monthly Australia, Art in Australia, Art Asia Pacific, Art and Text, World Art, ABC Online and Contemporary Magazine. She got hooked on art writing and art talking, I love that, when producing a weekly radio called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galleries on community radio station 2XX while she was still a student in Canberra in the early 90s. Maybe I'll just introduce you all and then I'll start throwing your questions. John Nalon is an independent author, curator and formerly head of education at the Art Gallery of South Australia. He writes for the Adelaide Review, lectures in contemporary art history theory at Adelaide Central School of Art, and recently won the National Scarlet Award for critical writing on contemporary sculpture. He has written numerous articles, essays and books on Australian artists including Stephen Bowes, Aldo Jacobelli, Robert Hannaford and Greg Johns, and he's the author of a new book on Greg Johns called The Edge of Time, published by Wakeful Press, which is being launched at the end of this month. Gillian Brown is a curator at the Sam Stagg Museum, University of South Australia, and a founding committee member of online arts writing platform Fine Print, whose interests lie in supporting ambitious and conceptually driven contemporary art practice. So we've got a nice, diverse group here to hear from. So guys, why do you write? What kind of things do you write? What are your favourite things? What are your favourite things to write? And what are your favourite pieces or styles of critical writing? Who wants to go first? All right, I'll pick. Eve.
In order. I knew I should have said yes, then it would look more confident. Those are a lot of questions. I'm actually thinking through how you come to art writing. I think it's demonstrated by the sessions this morning. For me, it definitely comes from the importance of art writing comes from having an authentic point of view and a necessary point of view. I started out as an art writer actually really in reaction to my art education, as much as I was as being a product of it. When I started studying in the 80s at the ANU art history degree, the main focus was on Byzantine art and medieval studies and European modernism, and it was literally Byzantine. And, you know, when we're all, you know, migrants, one way or another, sort of recent arrivals in Australia, I mean, there is a very strong relationship for me to European practices, and I'd just come back from a youth exchange in West Germany, but it just made no sense to be writing and researching about practices of which we had virtually nothing in our collections and which had no direct relationship or experience or politics relevant to me in my time. And so I finished my art history degree, and then I went across the road to the art school. And so I infected two arts degrees. And, you know, some similar sense of reactions came about that through me. Both my head lecturers in both universities said something to me about, oh, don't bother about going down to the Biennale of Sydney, it's just full of fashionable art. And I'd be thinking, if I wanted to be either a famous writer, curator or lecturer, or I just want to exist in this contemporary art world, and Canberra's 2.5 hours on the Murray East coach down the road to Sydney. What sort of recommendation or advice is that to give to art students or art writers or researchers? It's just... So I guess I felt very much at... I mean, the world is full of interesting things and subjects, but you do need to deal with the politics or the culture or discover the new culture or engage with what's rich around you. So I think I learnt more from my contemporary radio, my 1 hour a week, where I could get any artist or curator or writer or tattooist or designer into my studio and ask them questions and try and string a story along for them to sort of divulge their rich resources than I really did it out of any class. I'm not recommending this, obviously, as a great way to become a researcher, which I would never hesitate or pretend to be. But I do... I suppose I do think coming from this talking, writing, discovery legacy, I do think that the best art writing, and it can be in a variety of styles, really does come from an authentic point of view and a sort of a necessity, I suppose, when you're confronted with, you know, such exhibitions and projects and work that is often ephemeral or on an occasion of exhibition that's just a few weeks. Or wherever we live, we always feel that it's obscure or under-recognised, or, I mean, who comes to Canberra to see shows or whatever. And I know Australia has that particular disadvantage of being very geographically divided. I guess it's the idea of writing sort of... I sense it's a bit like putting your moral values to your craft and promoting and discovering new work for yourself and for the rest of the world, I guess, yeah.
Nice. Some people might say they only go to Canberra to see the art. John's got pictures.
I have pictures. Yep. This is my little PK. I'm being an Aussie here. It's in the diminutive form already. Let's go back to... They can go in any order, actually, Jonas. So where are we at? Oh, yeah, here we go. That'll do it for a start. Look, I just thought I'd throw a few... how's the audio? Is that okay? Alrighty, good. Just thought I'd throw a sequence of images up here just to give a sense of the kind of art that I look at on a weekly basis as an art writer and will write about it. So these are not here to talk about those individual works necessarily, just simply to say there's a diversity of those. So we can start off with a piece that was in Melbourne Now show, NGV, and it's some guys looking at a work of art that's been made by a machine, which apparently is becoming quite fashionable and trendy these days, so that's all really good. Thanks. So, but at the same time, a great deal of what we look at is... what I look at is an art in a gallery space of some kind, but then you have the added complexity that sometimes artists go into places like art galleries and apply their own filter, their own creative filter to that, as Deirdre has done in this particular work here. So there I'm dealing with a regulation work of art. In a sense, it's an oil painting on board, but at the same time there are complexities and layers to what's actually happening there. Sometimes the works of art I look at are scattered all over the place in a very fashionable scattery aesthetic of installation, and in the same gallery, the next room will be these most beautiful works of art made from glass. And they are two physically very, very different works. And my task sometimes as a writer is to see are they totally different, or do in fact they have some kind of common ground despite their initial kind of diversity. There are works of art that sometimes I think should be works of art but haven't been claimed as such, like the Terra Nullius I found on the road to Melbourne one day, and another piece of graffiti, which is a very clever piece down Hindley Street. They share common ground, they're very different, but to me they're part of the wider discourse of art, the wider art environment that's going on all the time. That distinction between otherness and between non-artists and the so-called art world, both these are outsiders and yet they're sort of insiders conceptually. At the same time, we can deal with works of art which are performative, where as a writer you actually have to literally be on the run in this case with this performance. It happened very quickly, Or you're dealing here with a work of art that's actually static within an art museum, but is also very performative in its own way. So you're dealing with, very diverse works of art, but at the same time they share common ground. And as a writer, you actually have to engage with them, think about them, analyse and reflect, all those kinds of things, before you can actually begin to write about them. At the same time, you could be find yourself looking at trees. On one hand, a kind of a very heartfelt piece of public art at Wakery, where, in their wisdom, the local community decided they would actually not cut these trees down entirely, but mutilate them in the name of art. And on the other hand, a very sophisticated, reminds me of the comment, the great art, great forest died that art might live, Barry Humphreys. But at the same time... No, that's fine, keep going, yeah. And also you're dealing sometimes with works of art which are huge and which actually threaten to take over the entire building or transform the entire building itself, and this is all taken from the last Sydney Biennale. Some works of art that you and I will deal with on a regular basis are made probably to ask you to think about things very carefully and deeply about a whole range of things, in this case to do with the colonial experience. Or other works of art may be there for whatever reason. Are they there to make families feel good when they go into the portals of NGV on St Kilda Road? Or maybe there is a deepness to this whole idea of people getting sucked in by cuteness and fluffy animals. And maybe Julia might have something to say about that a little later. Okay, and then we have the whole business of having to engage with works of art which are engaging with other works of art in some kind of way, as we see here in the galleries rehang, where there's a deliberate kind of butting together or banging together of art styles and works from quite different areas. And by the same token, that whole business of the dialogue or conversation that takes place between old and new. Art is a verb, a beautiful exhibition, and it had this, this agenda, which was to talk about the way a lot of ideas that were bred and incubated in the 1960s, which were of themselves product of data and so on from much earlier, were being revisited by contemporary artists today in Australia. And at the same time, the pedestal trope is being used as a vehicle through which to actually set up that kind of conversation. So these are all complexities. Sometimes you deal with vicariously or otherwise, houses that seem to have dropped out of the sky for one reason or another. And I think we're almost through. Some works of art appear to be relentlessly industrial and very new, and others are a fusion of old and new, or two quite different cultural elements, probably as Sue was talking about a moment ago in some of her work. Some works of art I deal with are about beauty, and they are also functional items. And other works of art are very traditional and they have their own sense of linkage in terms of the history of art itself. So, thanks, Sue. Basically, I think we'll just keep going very briefly. Also, probably as a writer on a regular basis, you're sometimes dealing with works of art which are very much part of the social fabric of any given day, an exhibition opening. But then later, that's when I come back and I actually have to start to think about, well, that's fine with everyone looking around at these works, but what are these works? What do they have to say? And that's when the real work for me as a writer starts. I'll stop there for now, thanks.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Jill.
I guess I come at this from a slightly different angle to even John because I'm a curator. And so the types of writing that I fall under my sort of role are quite different. So I often write to support exhibitions and artists, and it's largely unsigned, anonymous writing. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different approaches, and even with those sometimes very small pieces of text, it's so important to be able to pinpoint your ideas, and that's really what excites me about writing, is the opportunity to try and pin down some of those ideas that when you look at art that really excites you, start flying around in your head. And so using writing to pin those down and really drill down as to why that work matters is something that I really enjoy. It's the element of writing that speaks to me the most. So, like I said, I usually write primarily as a curator. There's also a lot of editing in there. So I really enjoy writing that is precise in its usage and its words, writing that is courageous, that isn't afraid to communicate its ideas clearly and stand strong on its ideas, and writing that's receptive as well. There's nothing better than reading a piece of writing by someone who is open to ideas and open to communicating that. They don't have to love what they're looking at, but they have to be open to it and ready to accept the concepts and ideas that are coming from that. There's so many different styles of writing, but those are the three things that really excite me about across all the genres of arts writing. So, yeah, there we are.
There you have it. Thanks. Now for the big one. What defines critical writing? So what defines critical writing? So we know that it goes just beyond informing. We met prior to today and talked about the idea, and I think you just touched on it then, Jill, is the idea of encouraging the readers to consider. So not just, you know, hand-feeding them boring, spelling everything out to the nth degree, but leaving it open enough to open the minds of the readers, to actually take part, I suppose. And Eve, you mentioned too that it's more out there in the world of communication, critical writing. Any thoughts, guys? What's its purpose?
I think if you're talking about critical writing, then I believe we're talking about writing or texts, if you like, that come across all genres and all styles. You'll find it at every level. You'll find it in very substantial tomes on contemporary art. You'll find it right through to catalogue essays. You find it in media and other reviews of exhibitions and so on. And I think they are elements or components that I think all of us would want to look for when you're encountering such writing. I think, you know, I started to think about some of those elements that might be. It would be that I expect the author will make or take some kind of position. But at some point you get a sense of that I-ness in the writing itself, that the person there has actually been through an experience in encountering that work of art and has considered it in some kind of way. So I say I'm also looking for an element of reflection, that is a sense of that person ingesting that kind of experience back into their computer somewhere and thinking about how it all fits with them personally, but also maybe thinking about a wider context. So the other thing is context. Sometimes I would expect very often in good critical writing there is a sense of how does it fit into the wider scheme of things, either that artist's wider practice. Does it relate to work that's been happening earlier? Is it kind of circular? Are things coming back to a point and being revisited? Or does it belong to a much bigger trend that's already has occurred or is occurring currently in Australian or elsewhere art of some kind? I would expect to see some kind of engagement, which means some devices that the writer will use that actually draws you in as a reader. So it's not much point in just having a piece of critical writing that actually is very boring. It has to have hooks. It has to have questions, it has to have surprises, it has to maybe have humour at times, and then we're drifting into the area of style. But I think these are elements that I look for, at least.
Hmm. What do you think, Eve?
Yeah, that's good, John. You've summed up a lot of it, I guess you would say. I guess I start seeing there between what is critical writing and what is good writing.
That old chestnut.
And I guess the strange thing with writing is a lot of it is also... The world is full of information and text and discourse and research, and life is just one big Wikipedia entry. And part of the idea of writing is almost to sort of condense or kind of try and filter through that just breadth of information, which is obfuscating, just to come to some realisation that is really useful or engaging or, you know, And also from a point of view, if a piece of writing exists kind of like an art on the artwork on the wall or wherever it exists, you want to persuade people to read, to keep going with you, and you want... It's a very busy world out there, and you don't want to waste people's time or underestimate their intelligence or reduce in any way the expectations or misinterpret the work. So...
pressure, isn't it?
It's a kind of a task there.
Yeah.
And it is, I guess it's kind of pretty close to creation itself, really.
Yes, we're going to come to that.
And sort of, it's interesting because arts writing really exists because of the art.
Yep.
And I think it's really important to think about the fact that writing services the art, not the artist or the writer as such. It's all there for that reason. And therefore, it's really nice to read writing that recognises that art is already packed with meaning.
Yeah.
That we don't need to force meaning upon it with the writing. We need to explore that meaning and tease it out and talk about it, but not try and impose anything upon it. And I guess that's something that I always look for in writing as well, that recognition that it's all revolving around the art itself. Yeah.
Music to my ears, can I say? That's fantastic. Oh, well, you know, I think everyone can identify with that in one way or another, either screaming for more or otherwise. So here's a curly one. Is critical writing the same as art criticism?
No.
So I'm going to... The sub-questions here, just... And I know, you know... mostly for everybody else. So we've got the master critic, a la Robert Hughes era, versus the art writer, the contemporary art writer. Eve, you said once that writers often don't want to conform to critical reviews. We asked each other, can writing for fellow artists be tricky? Are there protocols? Ray was originally going to be here, Raylene Forrester, and Gillian has beautifully stepped in because Ray's still in New York. But anyway, and Ray said artists want a bad review to better inform their practices. I took bad as meaning constructive. What's that? Go on, Chris, what did you say? Is it still possible to proclaim art as good or bad? And I know that's a whole can of worms unto itself. But is it the role of art writing to propose or identify whether the art or their subject is good or bad? And I love that you said earlier, Jill, that you don't have to like it, but you have to be open to it.
Yeah, I think I still enjoy reading good art criticism. It's something that I look for. And working in galleries as well, you do touch on that idea that it is so hard for artists really to get their work written about outside of things. And so that idea of having a constructive piece of criticism written about your work, it's so true. I've worked in a variety of galleries, and the minute someone gets written about it, it's exciting. It doesn't matter. Really. And that's... sorry. That's actually... I mean, I guess it's a problem. You shouldn't be so excited about someone that you work with getting written about that you almost don't mind if someone's trashing it or not.
Just it's
the
weird,
fact that
yeah.
someone's writing about it. That's a bit of a problem. But absolutely, the opinion comes into it. I want to read other people's opinions, but I don't have to agree with them. I don't understand this idea that, you know... that old era of master critics where, you know, someone comes out, writes a negative review, it's not going to stop people from looking at the work. You know, I'm not going to refuse to see something because someone else had a different opinion to me. It probably drives you to go and look at it more because you want to know if you agree with it or not and all that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, art criticism still has its place. It's changing, but it's definitely still got a place, and I'd be really sad to see that go. Well, it is going a little bit from papers and things like that, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with Gillian. I think it's, you want, if there's a role for critical writing, it is taking the art seriously, and no institution wants their media release or their statements just regurgitated back to them. You want something that is out there and demonstrates it's being taken to task or praised for the right reasons.
Yeah.
But it's true also, the art world is a very vested interest, and we're a small world, and it's a peer-to-peer network, and so it can be very hard to get people to write candidly and critically about artwork. And I suppose if you ask, if you want someone to write about something that where they have an actual engagement with the work, but you also don't want it to be so... I mean, I don't like it when artists, for instance, ask me to write a review of their show, and I would generally say no or try and get out. Because I think that's an inappropriate. It should come from an independent context.
Yeah, tip, artist tip. Are you listening?
And
hassle for reviews.
But you know, there's all sorts of different forms of writing and ways of getting around and declaring your interest in a subject. And I think that declaring or that position that you take with writing is always really important. So it does come back to point of view, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons why, I mean, the death of the master critic is partly because it was in the era of Robert Hughes there was such confidence invested in one person's position, and you know, for years the Australian art world was really desperate to have someone who could be an alternative to John MacDonald or Robert Hughes or Giles Aughty. There was just such a limited number of voices that claimed this master voice. But instead of really replacing them with more interesting, diverse cultural criticism, I think we came to just a plethora of different perspectives and they kind of got drowned out. But there is a role for art writing also because it is outside of the art world, outside of academia, outside of the small readership of art magazines. So the critical reviews are like, you know, between us and the vast population too, so it's very important.
John, resounding no, they're not the same.
I think that's important to make that distinction because at some point we need to actually tease out the whole business of not just think on art writing or reviewing in some kind of abstract sense, but the environment in which that is both produced and consumed to some degree determines the style and the focus and the intent of what's being written. So if you're writing for glossy art magazines or things where a lot of the trade, the commercial trade, is advertising, then there's an expectation when you write a profile on a particular artist that it's a well-rounded, scholarly kind of piece of writing. Whereas if you're writing online blogs or whatever, then it's full of opinion, as we know, very often. If you're writing in print media and so on, then it is more of a formal kind of a review. I had an interesting conversation with Terence Maloon recently when he was here with The Birth of the Cool, which is a wonderful show. Go and see it. And he made a really good comment. It stuck with me. He said reviewing or writing about contemporary art is easy because it's so new. Everyone can have an opinion about it. We don't know, and I'm looking at artists here in this group here today, we don't know what's going to happen in 30, 40 years' time. I'd like to think you're all going to prosper and grow and develop and mature and become even more complex and interesting than you are at the moment. And it's a very exciting pathway you're on. But sometimes when you're quite, you know, you're still formulating your grammar and your ideas, things are still in the oven. They're coming out, they're too hot to handle or to eat, you know. And so people like critics often have to sort of ride the tiger on this one and hope they don't fall off, because they often have to take a punt in terms of what's happening. And that's sort of critical reviewing at its edgiest or riskiest, because at the end of the day, we don't really know. I can mark the year when authorial art reviewing finished in Australia. And there are some people here who may remember it. It was 1974, and the exhibition Some Recent American Art came to Adelaide, as did Don Judd. And if you look back on the catalogue for that exhibition and the work that was produced and shown here in Adelaide, immensely confronting, because it almost went back to ground zero. You have people like Judd and others saying, a work of art is what it is. It is a piece of concrete. It's a piece of stone. There is nothing else you can add to it or interpret. We've got to get rid of all that language and all that claptrap and get rid of it all like that. And Carl Andre saying, art is whatever a self-recognised artist wants it to be or says it to be. Full stop. You know, so we're dealing here with, there was a time, and probably since that time, there has been a gradual leaching away of most lineaments of authority that most writers have. I know in America there are still some who command vast, in this case, internet or television audiences, like Jerry Saltz, for example. But I read the other day that there are less than 10 full-time art critics working in America today, less than 10 now, and most of them are working, you once had jobs, are out there freelancing like everyone else. Mm. So that whole idea of being the authority, the master, those days are over. If you read people like Adrian Searle, Jonathan Jones in the UK or whatever, and you read these, it's all about questioning. Matthew Collins is questioning. It's playing with ideas. It's defying or daring you as a reader to take what they're saying seriously. You know, it's a game, as Francis Bacon once said. It's all a game now, you know, and so we won't go back.
But it's also, I think the wonderful thing about that is it's also, it doesn't underestimate your readers anymore. So when you had the master critic, it was like, I'm going to tell you what to think about the work. Whereas writing now is saying, actually, you've got a mind, you've got a heart, you've got all your senses to actually respond and react and engage with the work. Here are maybe a few ways or avenues to go down to try start doing that, which brings me on to the question of how has the positioning of critical or art writing changed in terms of different styles and platforms? And
well, Sylvie, before we go,
yes.
I really think it's an important question here. How do we know, and do we know that artists want reviews regardless? How do we know that?
Well, I think it's fairly safe to say artists like reviews.
Even
and
bad ones?
Well, now, see, we've only got an hour, Bart. And however, you know, what was playing in my mind with that whole discussion previously to today and now is, all right, here goes. So how useful is a bad review to anybody, actually? Is the silence of no review more of a message? If that's the case, then how do you distinguish? How would an artist distinguish between a reviewer hating their work and or not, just by mere virtue of you can't write about every show that you think is worthy of singing its praises to the world? But in terms of, you know, I would put to artists who might have said to Ray, I'd love a bad review to inform my work. Do you really want it publicly, or is there another forum for that to happen? Can we, you know, can relationships between writers and artists, which we're going to come to later on, is that the context and the platform for that sort of discussion to go on as colleagues, as contemporaries? So, I mean, I'm not saying we should spend the rest of the hour talking about criticism
no,
and reviews.
I do have a solution.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah,
good on you, John.
What
Come
could
on.
Happen is that there's a Laurie Waxman, who's a critic, works out of America, New York, I think, and she's actually set up a system. It ran the Biennale in recent times, where she did 20-minute reviews. You could front, she'd interview you, and she would write a review in 20 minutes, and you'd go away with that in your hot little hand. And you had the satisfaction of being reviewed by a leading critic in that particular way.
Wow.
So there are these sort of interventions as well. But I thought of another one, that if people really do want something, then I think, well, maybe something more like a school report could be issued,
seen those lately? It's a whole different
And I thought of a few tick boxes, and they would be tick boxes only, but you would get... And you get it posted somewhere. So things like, could do better... Tries hard, repeats him or herself a bit, neat work, very promising. I like the blue bits in the corner. Or this is a very good one, a tired idea, it's been around, or I just don't like this, you know, big tick, big cross. But, you know, you are drifting into territory like that. And if you consider that most reviews now have come down from 1,000 to 800 to 500 to 600, we go online, they're 300. There's no way in the world that any sensible writer will try and write about a decent artist and say something negative, etc., that can't be backed up. You know, it's just grossly unfair. It's assassination. Unless you've got multiple voices, and that's another option in the same way as TripAdvisor has multiple you know. Mm. And we can learn from the commercial sector, there's no doubt. Anyway, enough from me. Cheers.
So, guys, just when you thought you finished your PhD and gone through all of that kind of, you know, assessment, guess what? It goes on. And I mean, I don't know, look, we could go on about this, but, you know, does a review have to be about that? Again, it's about servicing the art, and the best thing that maybe writing in public forum platforms can do is, I mean, I don't know, call me naive, but I thought that it was about servicing the art in terms of encouraging more and more people to go and see it and experience it.
I guess the thing with the reviews is you're not reviewing the artist. The artist isn't being reviewed. Ah. It is their work that is being reviewed. And that's something to keep in mind. It's hard to read. I mean, even as a curator, you can have a bad review. And certainly if you've worked with an artist who got a bad review, you would feel a little bit like that was aimed at you as well, yeah, as the facilitator of that. Mm. But at the end of the day, it's the work.
Yeah.
And it's not a person. Yep. It's not. It shouldn't be. I'm not saying it's not, because sometimes it may be if it's a dubious writer. It shouldn't be about character assassination. Yeah. It's correct. The work.
Well, I mean, definitely when you're commissioning reviews, I would be very reluctant to commission a review if I thought that they were going to be antagonistic towards the individual artists, the subjects. But if I was commissioning a review of a biennale or a major institution or a curated project, then I think that that institution deserves a seriously and possibly even wicked and salacious review. But you'd be very careful about doing that with any individual.
I smell litigation.
Yeah. Let's leave that at the
50
door.
50 cents a word, I can't afford it.
So, you know... so, actually, when we met earlier, John, you know, you pointed out that there's actually a lack of dedicated arts writers in major ags, has anybody noticed? Mm-hmm. And that makes me think of, you know, you just said earlier, Eve, that you know, no one wants your media release just regurgitated at you. And as curators, I mean, I remember when we used to write media releases to sort of like inspire the writer or the reviewer or whoever to want to know more and to want to come and have a conversation or see the work. And that just seems less and less, and it's feeling more and more like, let me write what you need to just print, because that's kind of, you know, that's...
You can end up reading stuff in papers and thinking, hang, I wrote that, I should get the fee.
That's exactly right. And they dropped a word out, for goodness sake, that would make... Anyway, blah, blah. This has led to writers setting up their own outlets, a la the ARI model. There's a recent increase in broader engagement, access and participation in critical writing, which we all talked about before. Eve, you talked about a focus on topics of currency, art and practice and evolution. And John, you talked about the need for more reflective or aftermath writing, for example, for biennials. And from fine print, you know, and I'm not going to ask you to put your hand up and embarrass you, but you should really have looked online at fine print, which is a very new online publication, I think we can call, yes, and it's brilliant. And it's a whole other way of looking at things in terms of creative and experimental sort of writing. You know, and with all of that in mind, and the increase, there's an increase in writing, is there more or less, you were asking Eve, is there more or less expression of opinion in all of that? And does critical writing celebrate opinion?
Well, I think the other thing about critical writing, I was just thinking, is getting beyond this kind of more general slant, is that art, in the old days, there was an idea of a generalist person who would write about art. And, you know, to a certain extent, I'm a generalist, but... The level of complexity of different narratives and different types of practices means, you know, you do want to tailor make those discourses. Mm. You know, I'm sort of thinking of the kind of practices like if I was going to review someone like Joyce Hintig and David Haynes at the Museum of Contemporary Art at the moment, or Symbiotica or Stellux and Anatomy Lab, I would really like to be getting someone with really coherently scientific analysis behind them. And maybe there is that idea that the art is proliferating to a whole range of specialist discourses, and that no one really, the boundaries of what is art and not art and what are not specific discourses and disciplines is a big part of that.
Yeah.
So perhaps that idea of the general critic too is, you know, it's a bit sort of, perhaps it's a little like a very limited level of criticism too. Mm. So, yeah.
Jill, did you want to talk about fine sense approach?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the three of us set that up because we wanted a... There was an interest in having a platform that would support different kinds of writing. I like the idea, it's similar to that. You would go to a gallery with a pretty good idea of the type of art that you're going to see. And so you're set up, so you're going to the MCA, you're set up to look at contemporary art. You know, trot off to state galleries, you're going to see a very different type of art there. Hmm. And you're ready for that. You're ready to take on those different constructs and the different ideas that are going to be thrown at you through that. And the idea with fine print is that it would set up a platform for a different type of writing, because I think you need a variety of writing. It's more interesting to read different, you know, all these different styles. And it's, I think, for writers, more interesting to be able to experiment yourself as well, to throw some ideas around, to try new things out. And things aren't necessarily always appropriate for the publishing platform that you're working with. I wouldn't expect to see the same type of writing in The Australian as I would on fine print. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that the same writer couldn't write for those two platforms either. And so that was the idea behind that. It's an online platform where people can experiment and play around with ideas, get us thinking about new ways of looking at work as well, and hopefully informing other people to, or inspiring other people to go and write differently, even about the same subjects that the writers write for about us. So it plays around with length and form and that sort of thing, and you can do that online because you've got the space. There's infinite space online, you know. You can you could write as long as you like, or you can make it as short as you like. You can, you know, you can write for audio or video. That's another thing I think that you've got the opportunity to do online as well. But it doesn't mean that it's meant to replace print either. You know, they've got to exist side by side. They are two really valid and vital ways of receiving information.
It's also great. What I like about fine print is that you create those little metaphoric worlds, those little subject themes.
Yeah, well, that was an idea. Because the internet is so infinite, we do try and pin it down with concepts or themes, but they're hopefully still loose enough that people can approach that however they wish, and to take us on their journey and that sort of thing. So, that was quite important for us, to at least put some bounds on it, so that, again, you know what you're wandering into and you're sort of ready to receive that. Mm. It's the idea of being receptive as a reader as well as a writer that was quite important and something we wanted to explore.
Phil, I wonder if you could break the mood. Serena, could I have the images up again? I looked up... art and poetry on the web, and there's a lot of sites starting to bubble up at the stage. And I found one that goes, where are we? Just keep going through, and we'll get to a little... here we go, art and poetry. So I just found this little piece here. Just go through, need to be able to read it first. Oh, sorry, I have to go back. Yeah, just give folk a chance to read the handwriting.
Oh, that's great.
I don't think you need me to...
Can everyone read that?
Maybe.
Do you want to read it out, John?
I'll read it out, because it's maybe a little hard to read the handwriting.
The Renaissance stopped the car.
The Renaissance stopped the car and looked around. By now, the Baroque period had changed its identity.
Next.
It had been very exciting to be the Renaissance. Perhaps it had been a big mistake. yes, the Renaissance had been a big mistake, just like everything. And there's a whole slew of all kinds of writing appearing on websites around the place at the moment. I actually went on to fine print and I found some poetry there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty quite exciting. There was a piece by two artists. Was it Madeline Bycroft?
Madison Bycroft and Michaela Dwyer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really, really amazing stuff, because it was actually a conversation, and it went, I want to hear the colours. And response, of course, but the brown is muted with confusion as to who it really is and was. It, but the kind of, that is not limited by expectations, wants to make itself heard. I won't go on, but I'm saying it's very free and blank sort of verse that goes backwards and forwards on the page, and there's a typographic kind of inflection as well, which is worth looking at. But it was very refreshing to sort of stumble into this. Instead of being faced with just a barrage of text that you kept bouncing off all the time. Had we time, though, I'd love to talk about text and language, because that is a real stumbling block.
That's another forum, Sala.
That's another
But that does remind me of, you know, at the EIFF when we had Louise Hasselton's solo show, and we said, who should we get to write your, you know, essay for your floor sheet catalogue? And she ended up asking, of course, Ken Bolton to write a poem, and it was one of the most insightful pieces of text
it
about her work that I'd ever written, ever read. I didn't write. Sorry, Ken. Oops.
It was like a gift, in a
it
way.
It was like a gift, and yeah, definitely. It was beautiful. John, do I want to ask you, will the trend of form over substance gather momentum, or is that, are we going to dig that deep?
Yeah, we've really drifted into a huge topic, and I didn't realise how big this was, really. I thought I knew, but I didn't. And I think probably very few here. The whole transition and paradigm shift that's taken place in the communications world, generally away from print, and towards online is massive and all-pervasive, and it's just begun, folks, as we know. The art world is picking up on that in various ways, and the first way to do that was something like ArtLink, for example, going online, and you were able to access articles and back issues and so on. But, of course, it's tumbled well beyond that entirely. And parallel to that, there's a whole lot of new considerations coming in that I'll only just dot point if I have time, which is a whole lot of new research going on as to how do we read on screen as opposed to on print. And the neuroscience is saying it's a very different way. And one of the things that happens in print that doesn't happen on screen is what we call deep thinking. So if you're thinking about what in parlance now is called long-form writing, that would be a 2,000, 3,000-word article and so on, that would involve some deep thoughts. They're not possible and very hard to deliver on a screen in the space of 200 or 300 words and so on. The other problem that's arising from that is that there's been an upsurge in what's called service reviewing, and that is that there's a lot of reviews getting made. A lot of them are being posted by freelancers, many of them very skilled, but freelancers, who are being paid on the number of hits that they get on that site. So no hits, you don't get paid. You get a lot of hits, all of a sudden they hire you back and to do that kind of thing. Those reviews are being co-opted into a lot of online art journals and mags now and newspapers as a means of hooking up with commercial ventures like commercial galleries. So you like reading this, you might like to buy that. And we're on the edge of a whole slightly murky, seamy, muddy kind of evolution that says, well, it's very exciting for people in the art world and the art publishing generally to get excited about going online. But at the same time, there are a whole lot of issues creeping in, and it's all about money. It's all about monetizing. It's all about paying your way. So you can actually operate as a small enterprise for a while, but as soon as you want to keep going, and those of you who write know that writing is just a hard slog and it's not paid very well. So people do it on a freelance, irregular basis most of the time. But if you can actually get hooked into an arrangement with publishers or publishing houses or magazines and so on, and your work is popular, they're more likely to actually take your work back on and you'll get paid. But that same copy you're writing is then bolted onto or enters into a kind of a close and personal relationship with the commercial world. Yes. It's more immediate now because people can blog, people can Twitter, people can give you a response straight away. And if you can actually build up a lot of followers, you can actually go and hock yourself around the world and say, I've got 5,000 followers. And you'll get taken on that basis because the advertisers want to know that. They want to know they've got people writing, they've got 5,000 people coming with them. It's getting very complicated.
I have to say, though, I think we do have been... I mean, I feel basically very positive about the opportunity for writing on the web. I mean, the opportunity to publish digital-first responsive reviews, which ArtLink's looking at as we unroll our new website, and actually have things genuinely accessible to a global and a larger audience, and the opportunities for archiving. And I mean, I think in a way, I would. I also think we have to be. I mean, the idea of a 3,000-word article. There's no reason why that can't be online. I mean, it is about how you present and design that. I think sometimes. I think online publishing is a much more complicated and diverse and really accessible platform than the paywall or the limited print editions could ever achieve. So I don't know. I think there's all sorts of ways of looking at it, but the technology can be framed in many different ways. Of course, funding for writing is always going to be a problem, but, yeah.
Yes, there are.
Jill, so we've got like 2 seconds before I'm supposed to open to questions, and we've got like 3 pages, which we're not going to do. But can you, Sarita, can you hang on to that one? Jill, were you going to say something then?
I think people are scared of it. It's new. It's a new. Well, it's not new. But it's a new way of thinking about it. We're just sort of opening ourselves up to it, and it's all about the way that we choose to engage with it, and thinking it through, not just launching into something. Naively and not thinking about the implications of it. So there are pitfalls in it. I mean, it can be co-opted in the way you were talking about there, John, about monetizing it and attaching it to commercial ventures. But the other end of that spectrum is it's relatively cheap. It's very easy to disseminate ideas across that way, and it's very easy to have them connect with other people. And it was something that we were excited about with Fine Print, was this idea that it could exist and document things that were happening now for people to be able to look back on very easily without having to go to a library and that sort of thing. And that's an exciting prospect, actually, to be able to go and have all of that information at your fingertips. And to treat that with suspicion, I think, is doing ourselves a disjustice. You know, that we've got to embrace it and work in the way that we want to. And if you take control of it, it can be a very positive tool, but it just takes everyone using it consciously for that to happen.
Yeah. So we're not going to go through all these. I think we covered a lot of this stuff already in what we've discussed. So we know that there's a huge shift in audience and reader behaviour patterns. John's touched on them, and it's about the different platforms. And it's great to know that ArtLink's going to go dual platform soon. And Eve, you've really shifted the whole sort of the nature of ArtLink since you've arrived too. So there's changes everywhere, and that's fantastic. You know, we were going to go into that whole, you know, but we don't need to. I don't think anyone here would debate that or would, you know, argue against the idea that writing is a practice in its own right, and that there are some amazing similarities between being a writer and being an artist, or an artwork, and or a text, which we've also touched on before too. Thanks everyone, thanks the panel, thanks audience.